One of the biggest disagreements in my marriage over the years has been on the issue of colors. I don't know if it's for biological reasons, if there's some kind of explanation that way, but for some reason, Kim and I, and isn't it nice that she's sitting right up here, front and center this morning, for some reason, we just see certain shades of color differently. So, you know, is it navy blue or is it black? Is it gray or is it silver? We, over 20 years now, have gone back and forth over disagreements like that around the issue of color. As our kids have gotten older, we've even kind of tried to pull them in to help, settle the tie. And that works sometimes, but then sometimes they disagree, and then, we're just kind of left retreating to our own corners on the issue. Actually, we typically can agree to disagree pretty well on that issue. It can get complicated, however, if, she asks me to put the green towel in the laundry and all I can find is a brown towel. So, these disagreements can sometimes be a little more complex than that. Well, this morning I want to talk about the issue of disagreements. We've been in this sermon series over these last weeks called Friend Requests, where every week I kind of bring to you a request that we might make of our friends. And this morning's request is, let's disagree agreeably. We all have disagreements at times. We don't all see things the same way. But we can disagree in very different ways. And I'd suggest to you that in the best of friendships, we find ways to disagree agreeably. You can look at the world and the way disagreements are handled in our society around us, and the popular term for the way that often happens now, maybe you've heard it or come across it somewhere, is the term cancel culture. The idea is, if you say something that I don't like, if you say something that I find offensive or that I disagree with, then I cancel you. I will boycott you. I will ignore or avoid you. I'll have nothing to do with you. I will even perhaps try to shame you for thinking or acting the way that you have. That's often the way disagreements happen in society today. I'd like to suggest to you, particularly if we are followers of Jesus, there is a much better way. Whether it's the way one Christian interacts with another Christian with whom they disagree, or if it's those of us who follow Jesus interacting with others in our society who don't share our faith, the way that we disagree should be fundamentally different. My premise this morning is this, and it's a very simple one, and maybe obvious, but let's just say it. It's that we can disagree without being disagreeable. Now, when you think about what it means to be agreeable, what does that look like? Well, we want to sort that out this morning. We want to talk about how we can disagree without being unfriendly, without being unpleasant, without being bad-tempered about it. We want to look at this issue, and rather than seeing the person who disagrees with us as the other, as that person that we need to cancel or avoid or ignore, I want to talk about, how do we stay in relationship with the other? How do we stay in relationship with the person with whom we disagree? And of course, on this particular Sunday, I'm thinking about much more than disagreeing about colors. We, of course, are coming to the end of what has felt like a very long election season. And so it's important for us to think about how do we disagree agreeably with people when we see things differently politically than they do, when we vote differently than they do. And so this morning, throughout my points, and I have four suggestions for you about how we disagree agreeably, as I go along, I'm going to be talking about how we disagree with the other, in quotes, That person that you see as other on the other side of you who is different than you on certain issues. And I'm going to encourage you to fill in the blank. Who is the other for you? Maybe it's a particular person. Maybe it's a particular group of people. Whoever the other is for you, think of them, imagine them as I make these suggestions for you this morning. I'm going to be bouncing around from scripture text to scripture text, so I'm not going to have you turn anywhere in particular this morning, but you can hold on and follow along as we think together about this topic. So, you know, the question is, what is it to disagree agreeably? What does that look like? And the first suggestion I want to make about how we do that and what that looks like, again, this might be stating the obvious, but let's state it anyway. It starts with holding convictions that are different than the other. It's holding convictions that are different than the other. Sometimes when we think about how do we disagree agreeably, the place that we might get to is, well, then we shouldn't disagree at all. I mean, we should just kind of like, you know, ignore the areas where we disagree, or we should you know, hit the mute button and not talk about those things ever, or we need to compromise on those areas where we have different convictions, and, you know, so that they, you know, the differences sort of bleed away, and we're just kind of this melted, merged middle ground that no one feels particularly happy with. Let me suggest to you this morning that to disagree agreeably does not mean that we just, you know, ignore or try to get rid of our disagreements. I want to suggest to you that we can and we should hold our different convictions very deeply and strongly. That we shouldn't necessarily give in on holding those convictions as closely and strongly as we do. I'd suggest to you it does no good for anyone if we can only ever have convictions that we all agree on or that we all share. We need to have our different convictions. But you don't have to be disagreeable in the way that you hold those convictions. You know, if you go to the scriptures, particularly if you go to the times of the early church, couple thousand years ago. You can look at kind of heroes of that period. You can look at Peter and Paul. You can look at James. You even can look at Jesus himself, and you can find strong convictions without compromise, and yet being able to disagree on those convictions in agreeable ways. Let me just, you know, very quickly jump into one particular discussion that Paul was part of. In Romans chapter 14, and we're not going to do any justice to this text at all, because it's Paul talking about one of the big disagreements of Christians at the time. But I just want you to see, to illustrate what I'm saying, what he says about our convictions. So in Romans 14, verse 5, we find these words. And again, this was a particular disagreement between Christians of the day. It says, Paul writes, one person considers one day more sacred than another. Another considers every day alike. Each of them should be fully convinced in their own mind. That's him saying, you know, have your convictions. Believe what you believe and believe it strongly. Be firmly convinced, fully convinced in your own mind. You don't have to compromise on your conviction. You don't have to hide your conviction. You don't have to try to, you know, melt your convictions together so that there's no disagreement. We can read the same biblical principles, and we can come out with very different practical consequences of those principles. We see that happening in the scriptures. We see that happening in the church and Christian circles throughout time. It's possible to read the same Bible, to hold the principles there dearly, and yet to live them out differently. One very practical way that that works itself out is on the issue of voting. You know, Christians can and do vote differently, and some Christians choose not to vote at all. Different convictions on that particular issue. And then, of course, there within that issue of who to vote for, there are a whole host of other convictions that weigh into the kinds of decisions that people make about how they vote. Can we get to the place of being okay with disagreements there? Can we get to the place of being okay with holding different convictions than the other person, but not having to sever the relationship with that person? Pastor Scott Sauls asks this question. He says, can we envision a world in which convictions are not abandoned but deeply kept, and that not in spite of but because of those convictions, friendships are made and honoring dialogue happens across lines of difference? Let's not just envision it. Let's let it be so among us. Hold your convictions and hold them strongly. But then we need to talk about how we talk about them. And I'd suggest to you that part of disagreeing agreeably is being able to hold our convictions and then talk about those convictions without feeling this intense pressure to persuade the other. It's being able to hold those convictions and talk about them without feeling like I need to convert you to seeing it my way. You know, if I could just convince her that it's light red rather than dark pink. When you go to the scriptures, you might think that Jesus, of all people, would be who was certainly persuasive. You might think that he, above all others, would care deeply about, you know, persuading others to see it his way, about converting others to his views. I mean, the stakes of his ministry were huge. He was trying to secure people's eternal destinies. He was seeking to reconcile people to God. I mean, the highest stakes in the universe. And yet he was surprisingly relaxed about other people's choices. You know, when people wanted to follow him, and as the crowds around him were building and people were eager to kind of get in on the Jesus movement, you know, people were ready to follow him, and you know, he called a timeout. He said, now, you need to count the cost before you follow me. Don't just sign on here without knowing what it is that you're getting into. Then when some of those people who probably thought they had counted the cost and then, you know, heard some things that they didn't like or agree with and they were ready to walk away, Jesus never chased after them. He let them go. You know, there are various times where, you know, he's confronted by the religious leaders. On one occasion, the religious leaders challenged his authority and even asked him the question, you know, by whose authority are you saying and doing the things you're doing? And Jesus walked away without answering the question. I mean, that would have been a great opportunity for him to declare, you know, hard and fast why he was doing what he was doing and who he was following as he did. And he chose to walk away. He's standing before the Roman governor Pilate, and he's been accused and he's been challenged. And he did not answer the charges. Jesus taught, he encouraged, he challenged, and yes, he sought to persuade. And yet he never seemed to feel this, you know, this pressure, this force that we sometimes feel within us that I need to make them see it my way. Let me suggest to you some signs that maybe you're not doing this well. Do you have to have the last word when you're having a discussion, a debate, a disagreement? If you always have to have the last word, you may not be following the example of Jesus. Do you come across as self-righteous, as smug, as condescending? Well, of course I don't. Maybe you could ask someone else about that. Do you bash or criticize or write off someone who sees things differently than you do, the other? In this political season, do you demonize? Do you spread half-truths? Or maybe you don't even know if it's true or not, but just in case, I'll put this out there. Do you exaggerate the best features of your side and the worst features of the other? Do you ever say something like this? You can't be a Christian and vote for fill in the blank. Well, just a case in point. You know, in 2016, according to surveys, 81% of white evangelicals voted Republican. In that same election, I think about 88% of black Christians voted Democrat for president. Now, which side was wrong? Well, I'm sure we have our opinions about that and could have a lively discussion about that. But can I just suggest, if your perspective is, well, you obviously can't be a Christian and vote for this person, is to miss the point. Hold your convictions and hold them strongly. And even talk about them. But don't feel the need to convert the other to see it the way you do. Consider Colossians 4:6. Paul, writing to Christians in the city of Colossae in the first century, says, "Let your conversation be always full of grace." Underscore always. Underscore full. And if something is full, what does that mean? It means there's no room for anything else. Full of grace. Let your conversation be a gift. That's grace. Are all of your when you have a conversation with someone, do they come out of the conversation saying, "That was a gift"? Let your conversation always be full of grace, seasoned with salt. That's kind of a first century way of saying, you know, let your conversation have some wit. You know, let it have some humor, some intelligence to it. Let that characterize your conversation so that you may know how to answer everyone. Can you talk to anyone? In a faith context, Paul says, be ready to answer anyone at any time. Answer any question they have. The way you talk about your convictions, can I suggest words like wise, patient, kind, gentle, respectful, humble, should characterize the way we who follow Jesus talk about anything? What if instead of approaching conversations as advocacy, you know, I'm advocating for my position to make someone else see it my way, what if instead we approached them from an inquiry perspective? You know, I'm not just talking so I can lay it all out for you, but I want to actually understand where you're coming from as well. You know, there's an interesting historical example of that. In the 1960s, during the presidential administration of John F. Kennedy, and you history buffs will know this well, there were two pivotal events in those few years that involved Cuba. One of them in 1961 was the Bay of Pigs invasion, where the U.S. sought to invade Cuba. If you know your history, you know it did not go well. It was a foreign policy disaster for the Kennedy administration. 2 years later was the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the Soviet Union put missiles in Cuba, just 60 miles offshore from the U.S. And Kennedy's administration decided to blockade Cuba. The outcome of that encounter was considered to be a great success, a victory. They avoided nuclear war and got the Soviet Union to back down. Now, behind the scenes, in those two episodes, there were very different conversations happening. Kennedy invited his advisors to approach the two differently. For the Bay of Pigs invasion, he had his advisors use the advocacy method, where they came in and argued their point. And ultimately, the idea of invading won the day, and that ended the way it did. For the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy used the inquiry approach, where he actually had his advisors come in and seek to understand the other position and then argue for the position that they did not hold. So the CIA had to argue for the military's position, and the military had to argue for the CIA's position. And out of that conversation was perhaps the greatest success of Kennedy's administration. If it works in foreign policy, maybe we could take a lesson for our conversations. Hold your convictions, yes, absolutely. Talk about your convictions, yes. Even try to persuade someone winsomely, but without feeling this sense of obligation that at the end of this conversation, they have to see it my way. Let me suggest to you the third way we disagree agreeably. We hold our convictions and we talk about them without needing to persuade the other. But then I'd suggest to you that we also look for common ground with the other. Hold your convictions, but also look for areas of agreement. So, you know where you disagree. Find areas where you agree. Seek to bridge some of those gaps. And I love in the scriptures the way Paul does this, particularly in Acts chapter 17. So Paul, at this point, he's the globe-trotting missionary going from city to city, starting churches, and he comes to Athens, the Greek city. And he ends up speaking before a group of Athenians. And he says this. He says, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious." So am I. Isn't that interesting? "I see that in every way you are very religious," Paul says to the Athenians. "For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. You're religious, so am I. You believe in this God that you don't know, that you can't see. And I believe in a God like that too. And in fact, I can tell you something about him." Now, Paul could have gone in. I mean, there were idols all over the city of Rome. He could have gone in, ready to call the Athenians out for their idolatry. I mean, I guess he could have gone around with an axe or a sledgehammer and started, going at these statues. But he didn't antagonize. He didn't even confront directly. Though Paul was certainly, if you know anything about the guy, he was certainly willing to confront. he began to build common ground, and he connected with some of them who wanted to learn more later. Now, I hope you know a few people who see things differently than you do. And assuming you do, absolutely, be clear about what you see differently than they do. But also think about what you have in common. And it might just be more than you think. Now, for those of us who are people of faith, I've said this before, and I'll say it again. For those of us who follow Jesus, we have something more important in common with another Christian in India, say, than we do with the non-Christian who lives across the street. Or maybe to bring it home a little more. We have something more important in common with a Christian who votes differently than we do, than we do with someone who is not a Christian but votes exactly the same way. Common ground. Here's my last suggestion for you this morning about disagreeing agreeably. It's about moving relationally toward the other. Now, you can be moving closer to or further away from someone with whom you disagree. And let me suggest to you that if we are holding our convictions strongly but talking about them without the pressure to convert the other person, if we're seeking common ground, then we can be moving closer toward the other person. That relationship can actually be growing. And we see Jesus doing this all the time. Jesus, the sinless Son of God, perfect in every way, with, you know, running around with limited, fallible human beings. I mean, if ever there was a person who could disagree with people and say, but no, I really know, it was him. And yet you see him going to the corrupt tax collectors' parties. And you see him going to the upright Pharisees' parties. Just extraordinary. In his own inner circle, he had Matthew, a tax collector who would have been colluding with the Romans, and he had Simon, a zealot, which was a political party that was seeking to overthrow the Romans, even by violence if necessary. I really wonder how that went. Apparently, Jesus was not worried about guilt by association. You know, he moved toward the people that he disagreed with on every side, on any issue. You know, not because he saw it their way, but because in his very nature, he is love. Here's where I want to end this morning. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal just within the last couple weeks, and maybe some of you would have seen this. I think I saw someone post it on Facebook, and that's how I came across it. But just illustrates this idea beautifully about two families, the Mitchells, who are lifelong Democrats. They planted a Joe Biden sign in front of their house in suburban Pittsburgh. The Gateses live next door. Lifelong Republicans put a Donald Trump sign in front of their house. And with their respective political signs, they each put another sign, and you can maybe see it in the picture here. Beside their political signs, they put these other signs that say, "We heart them," with an arrow pointing to the other neighbor. Chris Mitchell said this. She said, "There's so much hate. We want to send a message that people on opposite sides of the political spectrum can actually like each other and be civil." The Mitchells, Stuart and Chris, and the Gateses, Bart and Jill, met 14 years ago on their suburban street, and they quickly bonded. They each have three children that are about the same ages. They often walk to school together. They swim together in the Mitchells' backyard pool. The family share a love for hockey. The boys played on the same teams, and actually the dads served on the high school hockey board together. Stuart says, "Our lives are intertwined. We call each other family." So how do they get along? Well, the article gives some of their answers to that question. They don't argue. They don't label each other. They listen to each other's perspective. They look for common ground. They recognize that reasonable and good people can reach different conclusions. Chris says this. She says, "I think it boils down to respect. We have no desire or illusion that we're going to change them or each other's minds." Bart says, "We have a lot of shared ideas about what is wrong and whose needs need to be addressed, but we differ on the best way to handle it." And that "we heart them" sign came out of their Monday night tradition. They have dinner together as families every Monday night at one house or the other. You know, everybody gathers, and they were talking together just about how disappointed and upset they were about the hostility in the nation and locally. And so one of them said, "You know, I'm going to make a sign that says that I love my neighbors who see things differently," and the other neighbors reciprocated. Bart concludes this way. He says, "Our fundamental job as parents is to be a good role model for our children. They wanted their children to see that people who believe very differently can still get along." He goes on, he says, "We don't see them as Democrats. They're the Mitchells. We know they are good people who live next door. We love them." Now, I don't know what role, if any, faith plays in the relationship between these two families. But let me suggest to you, if we have Jesus in our lives, then we should be able to do it at least that well. At least that well, or maybe even better. Don't give up your convictions. I would not ask you to do that. And don't feel like you can never talk about your convictions. Let's talk about areas where we're different and where we even disagree. And let's also do so without feeling the need to convert the other, with a willingness to find common ground and a desire to keep moving toward the person that we disagree with. And may we do it for Jesus' sake and with his help, because that's exactly what he has done and continues to do for us. God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. For if while we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his Son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life? We end this morning with that incredible symbol of the reconciliation that is possible for us in communion. Worship team, I'm going to invite you to come as we prepare to do that. Let me remind you that in our disagreeableness, because we're all disagreeable when it comes to our relationship with God, when we're in that place of disagreeableness, Jesus desired to make a relationship possible between us and God through his sacrifice. So I invite you also to participate in this time of communion if you've experienced that reconciliation with God and with others. Ken is going to play a song for us as we prepare our elements and as we reflect. Thank you. as we take this bread.